Oxford academic timetables, I think we've just reached the 5 o'clock mark. And welcome to everybody. You'll see we set ourselves up a little bit like, it's like question time. It's the closest I'm ever going to get to being there, literally. So welcome to Oxford, welcome to question time. And I'd like to first of all start actually with some thanks. And those are the thanks to the people who organised this whole seminar series that's been going on this term. Particularly thanks to Alex Garantia, who's at the end here, who's been the main convener, and Sam Sneddon, who I just passed to find her way to the business school, so she should be here in a second. To Sanja, who most of you will know, who's been doing most of the work in the background, Aileen, Marshall Brown, and Eleni. To Jill Boggs and to Kate Patro, who've been doing the recording, so thank you very much to you. To the speakers earlier in the programme, who many of you would have heard, who I think have given us a fabulous set of ideas that we're picking up today. To Hype for funding the programme, and to the Business Hall and Nuffield for hosting the sessions. Today we're going to have a sort of a general panel, and I will ask each of our speakers to talk for, I think it's no more than 10 minutes each, and then after that we'll open up for a general discussion. So I'm going to introduce each speaker one by one, and then perhaps ask them for their 10 minutes, and then introduce the next one. So our first speaker, I'm assuming we're going on the order that's on the timetable, is Andrew Dilnot. Andrew will be known to most of you. He is the chairman of the UK Statistics Authority, and of course currently warden at Nuffield College. In addition to many academic affiliations, he has rich and varied experience, including serving as chairman of the Commission on the Funding of Care and Support, which reported in 2011. He's still the chair of the Statistics Users Forum of the Royal Statistical Society. He was director of the Institute of Fiscal Studies from 1991 to 2002, and has been an acting pro vice chancellor at this university. He'll be known to many of you, of course, also for the fact that he founded and presented the BBC Radio 4 series on the beauty of numbers and co-authored a best-selling book about numbers that Rory Bremner once described as making statistics far, far too interesting. That's a challenge. Today, Andrew is going to talk about public aspects of research impact and wider interest in and responses to the increased attention to impact and knowledge exchange in higher education based research. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
Roger, for those kind words. Lovely to be here. I'm really sorry this is the first of these sessions that I've been able to attend. I'm going to speak very briefly. And maybe what I'm going to emphasise is that we have a real duty to do this because the public debate is almost entirely in areas where we ought to be active and often is ignorant of the kinds of things that we might add to it. I haven't even taken a sample of today's front page newspapers. I've taken the front pages of all of the newspapers that were available in the Nuffield College JCR earlier today. So this is the whole set, and the order is random. So the front page of The Guardian, Michelle Obama's talk yesterday to a bunch of schoolgirls on the importance of education. Well, we have a whole education department. We've got some people from the education department here. We have a whole education department here at this university, higher education. Most universities now are taking the impact not of higher education only, but also of primary and secondary education seriously. Boy, do we have something to say in this area. A lot of the debate about the impact of education, which was what Michelle Obama stood up and said, look, you've got to take education seriously, it can transform your lives. Well, we really need to understand the impact of education. Measuring the impact of education is an archetypal social scientific activity, and it's quite complicated. A lot of the discussion about the impact of education is mind-numbingly not sophisticated, misses all kinds of things that are very straightforward. some of which, and these are close to my heart, are merely statistical. So an example we've got at the moment is, are academies more successful than other schools? Well, one of the things that can get you to be an academy is having been relatively unsuccessful. Simple regression to the mean means that some of those schools that have been identified and turned into academies will accelerate their performance, often from a lower base, more quickly than the rest of them. Does that mean that we should just assume that the academy has got to be engaged in these debates? What else have we got on the front page of the Guardian? Sex assaults on children soar, 25 cases a day. Well, many of our criminology departments, many of our sociology departments have got something to say about what's going on here, and we'd better say it. The Independent, so this is a photograph, this is the front page of the Independent, today's photograph of some family members of some of those who think the rest of their families have gone to Turkey and or Syria to join Islamic State in one way or another. Well, this is another area where the understanding, for example, of Islam, the understanding of the Middle East, we have in this university a great area studies group. We desperately need our discussions about what's going on here to be informed by the insights that will come from serious understanding of the culture and even the theology of those areas. The Financial Times, I've only got half of it because this is operator error on the scanner. But this says emergency plans as something like Greek bond turmoil. Possibly the largest in the last 5 or 6 years economic financial thing that might affect us going on in Greece, where we desperately need insight from economists, but also from political scientists, those who understand Europe. The Daily Telegraph, this is the top story was about the difficulties of motherhood past 35, fertility dropping off. One of the areas that we're seeing a big growth on in social sciences around the world at the moment is interested in the links between demography and other bits of social science. Here again, we desperately need, I mean, I'm pleased to see that there are figures from the Office for National Statistics being quoted. So there's some, this is a very delicate set of matters. And then roadworks hamper 1 in 3 car journeys. And you know, everything is here. Investment, the environment, the choices that we make. And I think finally, the Times save us cash in £250 million to buy cars and holidays. So this again, there's a demographic issue here to do with what's happening to the structure of the population, but there are economic issues here, there are psychological issues here. So this is about the reforms to pensions that are allowing people to access their pension funds. Well, how should we think about what people are likely to do once they're given new free access? A very simplistic economic model would say, oh, this won't make any difference to people's behaviour because they will have discounted all of this in advance. Well, it turns out that probably that's not the case. And my erstwhile colleague at the IFS, Steve Webb, who was behind this when he was the DWP minister in favour, he said he was, you know, we needed not to be too anxious that people would sell their pensions or buy Lamborghini as well. So why did I pick these? Well, I picked these because I think, so I care about impact because I care about the university appearing to do well, I care about impact because I care about the money that will flow to, but actually I don't really care about any of that very much at all. The reason that I think we should care about impact is we've got important things to say, and the debate that's going on out there in the public space is often nothing like as well informed by what we've got to say as we ought to make it. And that, I think, means that we have an inescapable responsibility as academics to describe what we're doing in ways that are comprehensible to and accessible and attractive to the people who are running this kind of debate. It's simply not good enough to say, oh, my work's rather subtle. I don't know how to explain it in ways that newspapers can understand. That is just, I think, not on. We have an absolute duty as we create knowledge and understanding to make it comprehensible. And often when people say, oh no, what I'm doing is too complicated, that's because they haven't worked it out clearly enough. And certainly in my own life, the most rigorous editorial process I've ever been subjected to has been when making radio programmes. Much more intellectually demanding than writing articles for peer-reviewed scholarly journals. And so I think we set ourselves... There's a lovely quote from Keynes. Keynes, I can't remember whether this is in the general theory or not, but writing about economists and forecasting. He says something like, economists set themselves too easy, too futile a task. If in tempestuous times, all they've got to say is that when the storm is over, the sea will be calm. Well, I think we set ourselves too easy, too futile a task if we say that our work is so subtle and complicated that we can't explain it to ordinary people. We're wrong. If we can't explain it to ordinary people, if we can't explain it in ways that are comprehensible, then the work's not very good. So I'd like to see many more of our colleagues in the academy represented in these kinds of discussions, because we've got things to say about all of them and we shouldn't be shy.
Great. Thank you very much for that introduction to the connection. Moving on, our next speaker is Dr. Claire Donovan. We haven't got the choreography right. Claire. Claire is currently a reader in Science and Technology Studies at Brunel. Her past affiliations include those with the Australian National University, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, LSE, National University of Singapore, University of Sussex, and the Open University. She's long been an advocate for considering the unique qualities of the humanities, arts, and social sciences within science-based evaluation systems. And in 2006, she was chair of an Australian Government Technical Working Group on Research Impact, where she championed the use of case studies and narratives alongside robust impact indicators. The work of this group influenced the design of REF 2014. Today, Claire's going to reflect on the Australian experience of their initial attempt to introduce measurable impact and provide an international perspective on assessing research impact.
Thank you for the invitation to talk here today, and thank you for organising such a wonderful and fascinating series. I've managed to make a few, and this is a great panel to round off the discussion, I think. I've been asked to talk about the international dimension of thinking about research impact, and some experiences I had involved in policy and impact in Australia, but that's policy in constructing what impact is for us as academics. And to reflect on some international challenges and international trends. So, briefly then, the so-called, well, the impact agenda, I don't like the phrase impact agenda, we can maybe get into that in discussion later, is something that's relatively new in the UK. Although saying that, it's been with us since the research councils, the early research councils were funded in 1913. But lately, we've become familiar with impact in terms of the research councils, but more formally in 2009, when Pathways to Impact became formalised. I'm sure most of us are familiar with that. And of course, in the last REF, where impact became one of the assessment criteria. Now, I've been involved in the study of research impact and in of policy making relating to research impact since around about 2005, when something called the Australian Research Quality Framework, or RQF, was getting off the ground. And that was basically Australia wanting to do something like the RAE, but they wanted to have an impact element in it. And when I'm talking about impact, I mean the broader economic, social, environmental, cultural impact of research beyond academia. And so I hope to bring an international perspective and, well, a longish view or a slightly longer view, taking the Australia experience into account. And I think I want to round off also with a cautionary tale. Okay. I think we've gone out of order. Okay, Australia's on QF. So, as I mentioned, I was chair of what was called a government technical working group on research impact, and it started in 2005, and we were asked to recommend to the chief scientist what would be the optimal methodology for assessing the impact of university research. And we were also asked to develop generic and discipline-specific quantitative and qualitative measures of research impact. Now, underlying this, there was a great deal of politics, and there was a suspicion that the humanities, the arts, and the social sciences, and the humanities in particular, had no impact and had no particular benefit to the taxpayer, which was the political language at the time. So in terms of the group itself, we concluded that the best assessment methodology was a qualitative approach and a contextual approach, and this had to be mediated through the judgment of academic peers and of research users, and that information was best derived from context statements, impact statements, case studies, and where appropriate, where they could be found, robust, relevant quantitative and qualitative indicators. So in fact, we were saying this couldn't be a metrics-only process. There had to be something more nuanced about this. And we also defined impact in terms of public value. Originally, we were given the domains of social, economic, and environmental. And a group called CHASS, which was the body representing humanities, arts, and social sciences in Australia, engaged in a very effective campaign to get cultural included as one of these domains. And in terms of defining social, economic, environmental, cultural, we consulted with the learned societies and the academies to come up with some quite detailed starting definitions. So, for example, I'll just go through social, which was improving quality of life, stimulating your approaches in social issues, changes in community attitudes and influence upon developments or questions in society at large, inform public debate and improve policy making, enhancing the knowledge and understanding of the nation, improved equity and improvements in health, safety and security. Obviously, that is quite broad. We also used to have a game with drafts of putting cultural first and economic last with the secretariat. The drafts would always come back in a completely different order, of course. But we also found that in terms of indicators, quantitative metrics were underdeveloped and couldn't be used as a proxy for determining ratings of research groups. In other words, panels just couldn't sit down with metrics and make judgments about broader impact. But when appropriate, some qualitative and quantitative indicators could helpfully be used to support impact claims. So the evidence that we presented was readily accepted by the chief scientist. We also recommended an impact scale, which is something that the rep here doesn't have, and I'm happy to talk about later. But that poses questions about what levels and types of impacts to reward, which is something that I don't think our rep has really got to grips with yet. So then came life and politics, and there was a change of government, and the new minister looked at the way that impact and the RQF had been put together. Kim Carr said the RQF is poorly designed, administratively expensive, and relies on an impact measure that is unverifiable and ill-defined. So the RQF was replaced by something called ERA, or Excellence in Research for Australia. And the impact element is judged solely on simple metrics in the form of patents, plant breeders' rights, registered designs, and registered commercialisation income, and that's it. In the meantime, when thinking about the development of REF 2014, the Treasury here announced that it was thinking of impact and thinking of perhaps the metrics-only REF. So there was a public consultation, And in terms of the impact element, Brand Europe were commissioned by Hefke to recommend the impact approach to use, and it was closely based on the approach that had been taken in Australia. A few weeks ago, or a month or so ago, there was a Reflections Day where Hefke looked back at Rep 2014, and we had a review of various findings about the quality and impact and environment aspects of the REV. The then Minister, Greg Clark, said impact was the grit in the oyster of the REV that produced a pearl. So the politics have changed somewhat. But we're kind of in REV limbo at the moment. We're trying to work out what will be the impact of how impact has been assessed in REV 2014. So the Hefke Review of Metrics, I think, is due to report on the 9th of July. And that will give great insight into how the impact component of REF 2020 will be designed. Will it rely more on metrics? Will there be a greater weighting given to it? So the world is watching and waiting to see what the outcome would be. And I know recently there have been delegations of research managers from Australia and Sweden in the country. They visited, I think, all of our institutions variously, and really do want to go ahead with impact as well. So, some observations then. What's changed during the past decade? Well, 10 years ago, one size fits all was the default setting. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think humanities, arts, social sciences, and the different sciences are being viewed in their own right, and not everything's being squeezed into just one framework or vision. I think that mixed methods and narratives are seen as state of the art. I think greater work needs to be done on including robust metrics, and I would imagine that will be where the greater work will be happening in the run-up to the next round. And there's definitely been greater international policy exchange and learning between various bodies responsible for impact-type exercises. What could be disrupted? We heard last week, I think Roger said that various colleagues could be suffering from something that we might call REF fatigue, and at the moment don't want to see another case study for as long as they live. And I talk about REF fatigue and potentially committing metricide, because if we don't want case studies and we don't want narratives, what will go in its place instead? There's also something being talked about called light touch peer review, and this is the extent to which metrics can help the peer review process, or can be seen to be a balance to the peer review process. But the question is whether that means panels will be given different types of evidence, including metrics, on which they base a decision, or there are advocates of giving panels metrics only if they make their decision on that. Okay. So just to round off, I think sort of looking over the past decade or so, there seems to be a general starting point in different countries, different parts of time, saying let's have impact metrics. They're simple, they're cost effective, they're transparent, they're replicable, and they're objective. Initially, these were scientometrics, so basically bibliometrics, looking at the numbers of publications and citations to publications, but really does that have anything to do with broader impact? So okay, technometrics came along, so things like patents, numbers of spin-out companies. Again, does that speak to the whole sector? And does it mean anything beyond a certain basic level of activity and wider impact is many stages later than just what's being counted? Then sociometrics, so looking at bigger data out there, looking at changes in the crime rate or the divorce rate, for example, but how can that be linked to the efforts of individual research groups? One reviewer of an article described sociometrics as giving alchemy a good reputation. And we now have the advent of art metrics, which may have lots of promise, but I think are not robust as yet. So we go full circle, we find that impact metrics perhaps aren't robust. and they're not simple. They can be quite expensive, can be very opaque, and there are various issues there. And various impact metrics tend to privilege the sciences over the humanities and some areas of science over others. So then the idea is to, we should have narratives and case studies, and then comes complexity, and then comes more bureaucracy. And someone new comes along and says, this is a mess, why don't we have impact metrics? They're simple, cost-effective, transparent, reliable, objective. So I'm coming up to my final slide now. So what's at stake? We can have definitions of, for example, the social public value or benefit or impact of research. That's something that us as an academic sector can help to craft, can generate bottom-up, can make inclusive of what we do. Or we could commit metricide and have patents, plant breeders' rights, registered design, registered commercialization income. It's important because QR money is tied to this, so ref fatigue aside, which would we all really prefer? And I'll hand it from there.
Thank you very much. That's brilliant. Thank you. Okay.
Hi, Hannah.
There you go. Okay.
We've all been told to stand up
there. That's fine. So, our next speaker is Colette Fagan. Colette is Professor of Sociology at the University of Manchester. Her research focuses particularly in the fields of employment and public policy, and she's the UK National Academic Expert in the European Commission's Expert Network on Employment and Gender Equality, and a member of Eurofound's Advisory Committee on Working Conditions. She led the preparation of the University of Manchester's REF 2014 submission to both panels C and D, and is the university's academic lead for managing the ESRC Impact Acceleration Account. So it's going to be drawing on that experience that she's going to talk today about the interface between universities and the research councils and other funding bodies.
Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me to this seminar. It's very, very interesting. I'm going to do three things. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about the faculty I work in, because we all work in different organisational structures. I'm going to talk about the evolving REF in climate of knowledge exchange and impact for research, and where I want to get to is the opportunities and risks for academics within this institutional framework. So, humanities is, Manchester covers five schools across all the social sciences, arts and the humanities. We ended up with the humanities label. That's why I always have to explain I'm a social scientist and a sociologist within this. There were 36 disciplines, about 1,200 academics, on which we based our REF submission. It's diverse, the range of methodologies, the issues we tackle, and it contributes to the world around us, and it impacts in a number of ways. We have our development, our accounting and finance people, our sociologists, conflict and disaster relief, history at the bottom in terms of the meaning of historical memorials to communities. So there's a whole lot of impact which we do with our research, whether we measure it or not. Why do we do it? Well, Andrew already gave us a very clear intro on this. Why is impact important? It's a worthwhile thing that we do as academics. We can engage a number of issues built on our research and our interests. It's one of the ways universities can make a contribution. That's for Manchester strategic mission. I'm sure there's something similar in Oxford's documents and indeed every institution around the UK, if not the world. That actually predates the introduction of the language of the impact agenda. It's present in the research councils, and as we know, it was really given a kickstart by the innovation in REF 2014, where it measured 20% of the overall funding formula. And if we continue in the direction of travel, despite a change in government, we're looking at a possible increase in the loading that comes on the impact of our work. So it's a good thing to do, and there are instrumental reasons for doing it as well. What did we do? A little bit in Manchester. Well, across our two panels, we had to do 81 impact cases. They covered the full range of impact allowed in REF, and let us remember Refuse's particular definitions of impact. And when we got out of the end of this, we were quite happy with our result. 91% in humanities were rated at 4-star, 3-star. So, what did we learn from this exercise? Well, first, as indeed across the sector, it was a steep learning curve for many of us. It involved retrospective capture for many of us. And it was hard work and resource intensive, both for the army of support staff and academic leaders, and the individual writing their impact case and being called to redraft, to boil it down to the crisp text that Andrew alluded to in terms of Radio 4 broadcasts. Hard work, but actually, personally, and I think institutionally, very, very rewarding. We were quite nervous when we went to some of our disciplines, and I have classics. I had to think, how are we going to find a case which has impact but fits this ref formula? And yeah, we did it. And we also, when we started, thought, oh my gosh, and in Manchester, humanities sits on one side, and the three science faculties sit on the other side of the road. Across the road is going to be a lot easier, and we're going to have to learn and run from them. And you know what? They were learning from us as well. So that was really quite enriching when we got over the lab proof of principle IP as the only model of doing ref. So it's good to do. However, 91%, the whole sector rated itself rather favourably. Panel C&D didn't rate itself quite as high as the health sciences, but we were all perhaps a bit relieved, reassured, or a bit backpacking, because we knew we had to show the government that we were doing impactful work. We can expect the bar to be higher next year, next time. The bar's raised for every time we go into ref. And we can expect more debate about what is judged 4-star, how we measure it, whether it's metrics, whether it's narrative, and what will count as evidence. So that's the uncertain terrain to go into. The other part of the environment is just to draw your attention to the ESRC Impact Acceleration Accounts. Now, like Oxford, we were one of the three pilots. We are one of the 23 institutes in the sector that have been given an award. And these are great to have. They provide a valuable contribution to supporting, resourcing, engagement and impact. And they allow a certain amount of institutional flexibility. So I'm a really big fan, and I'm not just saying this in case the ESRC see the podcast. It's helped us to do lots of really good stuff. And just to date, I've put up some of the headlines, 4 placements, 7 projects, 7 policy evidence seminars, and 35 projects. Clear engagement with external partners. Test case for much of humanities is, can you get the commercial business sector involved? 18% of our partners are, and it's leveraged in 450k. And this is partly some of the KPIs the ESRC is looking as it itself learns how to make these accounts run effectively. Here are a few examples. Big data and urban waste management, rights of undocumented migrants led by our law school, age-friendly guides to urban space working in Manchester City Council. Range of outputs. The one that's missing and should have been here, as I reflected on the slides coming down, is it's also led to research bids and academic outputs. And this follow-on circle of building relationship, shaping agendas together and going forward, as well as all these new formats that we have to learn how to do to get our message out there. And one of our biggest ones, actually, and I hope it's not a problem at Oxford as well, is getting our academics, when they organise the policy events, to think outside the box and not do an 8-hour event and expect a policy user to come up and sit through it, because this is no way of fully engaging, and arguably even academics, we don't need to be sitting in a room 8 hours. That's one of our activities. Again, we can see it right across the sector. We're all building portals, points of contact, single point entries to engage and to make it easier to read what our university is doing. And this is our policy facing one policy at Manchester, but you can almost pop them picking up across the sector when you look at job ads, etc., in the Times Higher. So, where do I want to end? I want to end on opportunities and risks for academics. And these are the kind of issues we have worked through with our colleagues and indeed ourselves as academics. When you do it, it can be hugely satisfying, but it adds more work. And for us, some of the things we've had to address is how to persuade and support colleagues that if it's one more thing to do, we're going to help them do it so that it's not as intensely demanding and detracting from time for research, teaching and so forth. And indeed, there is a skill of learning how to do it, and we're all going to become media savvy, and then we'll all have to do it a little bit better to make sure it's our newsletter which is being picked up in the ministry and not another, or it's us who are getting on Radio 4 and not another. So that's going to be a spiraling one. We've also had people saying, at last, I've been trying to do this for years, have been doing it, my institution hasn't recognised it, and I've done it despite, but now there's a clearer route and support to enable me to do it. The so-called applied researcher, which when I took my PhD was a very derogatory term, you did sociology theory or you did applied. We've seen a little bit of a redressing of the balance. Done right, for certain topics, it can enhance the research design and quality. But others fear, and quite rightly for some projects, but it can end up being the tail that wags the dog, or constraining your agenda because you're so busy about getting a good pathway to impact, but everything else has to be slipped and moulded and diluted to get there. So one of the biggest skills we have to build into our academic training, right from PGR upwards, is the confidence not to do it, to realise that not everybody has to do it at every point in their career to be doing good academic work, and that the research design should not be led by impact. It's clearly helped contribute to raising government and public understanding of the value of humanities. We can see that in the way the impact cases came out and the quotes around that, and in the campaign for social science, where it's used a lot of this evidence to show, hey, we do have a value beyond producing and interpreting poetry or sociological understandings of the world. But it also raises huge conceptual and methodological issues, which other panel members have mentioned and will be going on to. We face issues of bar raising of how we measure it. We face formulate learning of how we all write pathways to impact. As a peer reviewer, I can see standard things coming out there, and we're all going to have to think how we do that. We face user fatigue, endless requests to write testimonial letters for REF, or to come along to all these events, or to send us a favourable email explaining why they can't come to the event, as we all gameplay to capture the evidence for the narratives. And really a recognition that some of it is the slow burning has been LREF cases. These have been the ones which have emerged as our strongest of humanities. I won't blow my own trumpet too much, but I was one of the cases, and it took 15 years for my research to build an impact case. That's 1 year after I started to finish my PhD, and a colleague asked what it was as I came in, so I'm not going to show you the fair trade chocolate, although I'm very proud of that one. That was mine. That's 15 years' work distilled down to a nutty statement at the start of the impact case. And boy, did it take a lot of academic effort and nudging from our team to help me get my statement down that briefly. Thank you.
Thank you. Was fair trade chocolate somebody who started with?
No, Sussex. Okay. Oh, she may have started here. Yeah. Stephanie Berry-Entles.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Our next speaker is Alex Lansing, who needs a little introduction to this audience. Alice is Director for Research and Associate Professor in Fitz University's Department of Higher Education. She was the Senior Impact Advisor when we did our REF in Oxford. Her recent work includes a study of indicators and metrics for research impact in clinical medicine, another study on practices of impact in STEM, social sciences and humanities, as well as a study of innovative methods for capturing the cultural value of research. And she talked about this recently, a textual analysis of the REF 2040 impact submission by Oxford. She's currently leading on a HIFE project on knowledge exchange in social sciences. And she's going to talk, I think, a little bit about the conceptual complexities and relational nature of impact, including perhaps a reflection on the Oxford REF. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Roger. I want to make and just sketch an argument in 3 points, picking up some of the themes that my previous speakers have already detailed. First of all, I refer to the research policy landscape and the incremental change and move towards more attention to impact and to different kinds of impact over the past few decades. Secondly, I make some points about the higher education institutions' responses to this shifting landscape. Responses that amount to an evolving economy of finding, creating, giving, documenting, and demonstrating value or impact in other terms. And finally, I want to challenge some of the notions of impact that we have been using in a lot of the public debate recently and question whether, first of all, they capture the relational nature of the of how impact is generated, and secondly, whether they capture what is deemed as inherently and deeply valuable both by academics and by people outside higher education institutions. So my first point, research policy. We all recognize those terms, I think, from wealth creation through user relevance to connections with industry. And we can also project back several decades to core reports that supported the growth of these terms and they're becoming prominent in the public space. But despite the fact that the public debate seems to have been dominated by a lot of these discussions, what I find interesting is that in the background, what seems to have happened was a renegotiation of the principles underpinning the relationship between universities and the state. And that renegotiation's aspects of the of outcomes of that renegotiation include the introduction of performance-based funding and performance-based assessment, more concentration for research funding, and more recently, particular forms of accountability for impact. And all of those things have become conditional for professional autonomy and for self-regulation in higher education institutions. At the same time, a whole assessment machinery has grown in the background to support this, these renegotiated principles and practices. And that machinery of assessment has become increasingly stratified. Different ways of assessing apply at individual and publication level, at institutional level, and at system and field level. And it's also become increasingly specialized, with lots of substantive expertise in the field being assessed still being required at the individual and publication level of assessment. But new forms of what I call procedural expertise being in huge demand at field level and above institution level of assessment. Procedural expertise means understanding and knowledge and skills that have to do with running the exercise, the assessment exercise, be it the REF or any other form of exercise itself. And in that process, a new vocabulary seems to have emerged. Again, a stratified vocabulary. And what I'm showing you here are a number of metrics, indicators, and criteria that have been used at those different levels in order to refer to aspects of research quality and research impact. And they include the REF criteria as well as a set of references to indicators of significance and reach. What I also find interesting is that we've seen the emergence of what's called the meta indicators or meta vocabulary, which is a set of artifacts or byproducts of the assessment exercises themselves. An established example at field level includes the fourness of a discipline, which is based on a REF judgment. At higher education or unit, research unit level, we've had lots of media discussion around point score averages, research intensity, research power, all sorts of different ways in which institutions may be compared. And at individual level, from interviews that I've carried out in different places across the country, we have references to the referability of an individual, to the 3 or 4 stars of a publication. More recently, I had a really good one, which is the 4x4ness of an individual. I'll let you guess what that means. And there's also a lot of references to their impactfulness, be it of individuals or of research projects and programs. So aside from adopting and internalizing this vocabulary and contributing to its proliferation, what have higher education institutions done? What were their responses to all of this shifting landscape? Well, they've gone through a process, I would argue, of organization and recalibration. They've bought into the specialization of assessment aspects, so there's a lot of new procedural expertise that has been flourishing within institutions. There are monitoring systems and contractual relationships with people who can enable institutions to navigate the complexities of those assessment processes. There have been structural changes with new roles added to institutional structures from project officers all the way to senior impact advisor to REF manager and so forth. There have been changes to incentive structures, including having impact or impact-related elements as part of recruitment and promotion processes, and so forth. They have also connected to what I call an impact industry, so with a range of tools and methods and metrics that have proliferated and created a market for themselves, into which institutions are buying or not buying, in particular in relation to buying monitoring systems and systems for capturing impact. But in the background of that, what I feel has also happened is a lot of identity work and different ways of trying to anchor the impact agenda, the public state of impact, into different types of institutional missions and visions, and also into different types of disciplinary traditions. There have been those linkages that people make between what's happening now and the kinds of commitments that have been driving their work in this type of institution or in this type or in this particular discipline for a long time as a way of making sense of these requirements. This is from an interview with a principal investigator who said, yeah, well, that's fine. But for the purposes of the REF, what we did was to count, to itemize, to show direct links, to explore things as how causally as possible, to find all of those direct linkages. And the way in which those things were done was to identify different stories, different narratives that could be told. This is based on a narrative analysis of just under 300 case studies actually submitted to the REF, carried out by my colleague Stanja Antonasimovic here. And a number of types of narratives seem to be connected more closely to some disciplines than to others. And again, I would let you make your own mind about these, but perhaps trial and problem solution might be more connected to one set of disciplines, whereas demand, problem solution, with another, innovation and spin out with yet another set of disciplines, and contribution and engagement is probably a bit more distributed than some of the others. Interestingly, all of this diversity of narratives and references to impact seem to be falling into, according to our analysis, about four types of plots for the current case studies. One is the climactic one, when you start with a number of statements about what may have happened and to what effect, and then you close with a bang, with a statement that is so impressive, you know, and as a result, that many hundreds of thousands of lives have been saved, that the reader has no choice but to read a case study in that light. The headline plot, it works the other way round. It starts with a big statement and then it gives some supporting evidence. And then there's this mixed version, which is a key examples model, where you have more than one type of impact in one case study. And each of those types of impact may have a climactic or a headline construction in its own right. And what I find interesting about these particular case studies is that of all of the different types, these are the ones where areas of impact that are generally perceived as riskier in REF terms, cultural value, discursive shifts, policy debate, and so forth. This is the kind of case study that makes space for that, partly because the risks are mitigated by the fact that there's more than one type of impact being described in that case study. And then there's the chronological structure, which is far rarer, and possibly less well regarded by the panels as well. And they supported these narratives with a vast range of evidence. This is based on analysis of the Oxford submission, which is clearly led by an emphasis on testimonial evidence. And you can see web and old metrics, Claire mentioned them earlier, right at the bottom of that table. So it'd be interesting looking for the next round to see whether there are going to be any shifts in terms of the kind of evidence that people place most weight on. Going back to my interview, so we did all of this stuff for the REF, but they caution, we have to be careful not to become prisoners of those metrics. Why is that? Because there was a sense amongst all of the people I've interviewed that what really gets you into work in the morning is a sense of responsibility, which chimes with what Andrew was saying earlier, and a sense of the worthwhileness of your work, which connects very directly and organically with the world outside academia. So for my last point, I want to bring attention, first of all, onto the fact that impact is generated relationally through a vast mesh of interactions, and with all of which have a social and a human dimension, but also to the fact that impact is not the flat notion that we perhaps have become accustomed to, which the only differentiation within which has to do with domains, you know, impact on health, impact on education, impact on impact on that. But in actual fact, there are a range of meanings which are encapsulated by this particular notion. And these different meanings matter in different ways and often in powerful ways to people both carrying out research and being engaged in other ways with that research. So this is my clumsy attempt of capturing some of those different meanings. Here in the center of this drawing, which is far too neat for what I wanted to do, there's this word connectedness, which has to do with impact as the set of relationships through which a research project evolves and unfolds. Notions of co-production and co-design fit very well with this particular understanding of impact. And then you get all sorts of different partners from different parts of academia and beyond. And then around this you have this area which I call visibility. Maybe it could also be called dissemination. So it's pushing research into the public domain, to different audiences and to different promoters, making sure that it is heard of and known of. And then around that we've got this more straightforward notion of application and use. And a slightly more complicated notion of benefits, societal, community, and individual. These benefits could be measurable and quantifiable in a more straightforward way, but they can be more. They can also be rather qualitatively complex and more difficult to measure. I think we're still some way to go before we can claim ways of articulating those particular kinds of impacts. And then there's this very large circle around that, which I called cultural diffusion for lack of a much better term. And that's to capture all of those notions of cultural value, of discursive shifts, of knowledge creep, you know, subtle and incremental processes through which knowledge may have an influence on people's lives and on the public sphere. Now, the further away you go from the center of this diagram, the wider the scope of impact is. But also the further away you go, the harder it is to make an attribution of a particular claim for impact to a specific research project or individual. What the REF seems to have asked us to do was to gather evidence about those things and use it in order to support claims about those other two. And we've done this to the best of our ability and to the best of the data available to us retrospectively. But what was lost, I feel, in that process were the riskier areas, the qualitative benefits, the harder to capture things, the cultural shifts, the influence on language, and so forth. So I would be quite interested, again, looking to the next round of the exercise, in seeing whether there are ways in which that perception of risk can be reversed and different kinds of impact may be included in a more generally phrased exercise. So, evidence metrics, yes, they need to be technically refined, but they also need to be pitched at the right level so that they catalyze rather than narrow down research. The narratives that we build need to take into account the kind of relationships through which impact is generated, and also to account for the textured meanings of impact that I was talking about. And the condition of this, I hazard to say, is that we have a healthy ecology of higher education, not just of institutions themselves, but also in terms of their relationships locally, regionally, nationally, and internationally. And that may be conditioned by intellectual autonomy, financial sustainability, and insightful governance within higher education institutions. So I would say, if none of those conditions are fulfilled, then the high-stakes assessment of impact would simply capture assessment-driven hyperactivity, rather than capture that sense of responsibility and sense of value and worthwhileness of research in the views of both researchers and people outside academia. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Alison, very much.
Our final speaker is Ian Wilson. Ian has been Pro Vice Chancellor for Research in Oxford since 2009. He chairs the University Research Committee and he's responsible for coordinating the university's relationships, I guess, with its major research funders. In real life, he's also the Professor of Experimental Physics. Ian's going to talk about or reflect on some of the strategic issues in a research-intensive university, particularly in relation to impact.
Rather than talk, as colleagues have done here, you've had a lot of sense of the detail, I'd just like to talk about or reflect back to what Andrew's noted about the roles of the universities, because I think this role of impact is important for universities. So I'm going to just say a few things here. This is a Chancellor of the Exchequer under Queen Elizabeth II, George Osborne. I've taken a quote from one of his speeches there. I will say up front, I'm assuming it's under CC BY license, which means that I can take it and repurpose it for anything that I like, as long as I attribute it. I'm attributing it to it. And he says something reasonable. A government's job, and therefore partly university's job, if you like, because they're supporting universities to some degree, create the right ecosystem for ideas and firms to flourish. So ideas to flourish, I think, is actually a key an important element of what universities do for society. They help society reflect upon new ideas, right ways to do things, wrong ways to do things, radical things like 300 measures. We should think about that. And this is a good place for us to think about it before we actually have to get into the nitty-gritty of really implementing those things. Now, that sentence ends in a comma because, of course, I cut out the rest of his sentence, which is entirely to do with economic impact, which I didn't want to really address. Because I'd rather turn to an earlier Chancellor, Sir Francis Bacon, under Elizabeth I. And he wrote this book, Proficience and Advancement in of Learning Divine and Human. He states in there, what is the role of partly the academy, partly learned societies, for the glory of the Creator and the relief of man's estate? Now, I would translate that in the modern way to say it's about understanding what the world is, understanding our place in the world, and using that to make the world a better place. And if I translate it that way, I think it's much less prosaic than our current Chancellor, understanding that he was probably under different sorts of pressures. But that, it does seem to me, the context in which we should be seeing what research does and what impact does. Now, one of the, another guy that I'd like to introduce here, Clark Kerr. He's sort of, as I don't know if you can, it probably is inappropriate to say you can have a hero as a university administrator, but if you would have such a category, he would be mine. Clark Kerr, he was the first Chancellor of the University of California, designed the California higher education system, which I think is absolutely a marvelous system for helping everybody realize the opportunity that's possible at each stage. So he wrote this book, The Uses of the University, it's the Godkin Lectures cast from 1960, and he really talks there about the various stakeholders that are within the university, and I think you can see them going back to Francis Bacon, the students, the faculty, and the outside world. And it is the conjunction of those elements that he says makes the modern university. It's not a university, it's a multiversity because of the different stakeholders. And in that sense, I think impact becomes a core part of an academic mission. But how should we consider, one reason this guy's a hero of mine, he has a fantastic sense of humor. So he was the Chancellor of Berkeley in 1968 when there was a bit of student unrest, just a little bit. And the regents of the University of California did not like the way he handled it. So when the new governor of California came to power, the first thing he did was get the regents to get rid of CARE. And CARE was asked how he felt when the regents did that. He said, "Well, I am leaving as I arrived, fired with enthusiasm." Good joke's worth a lot. So how should we conceive that idea, though, of impact being part of a university as a whole? So this quote is from Abraham Flexner, who was one of the leading academics in the late 19th, mid-20th century, founded the Advanced Study Institute at Princeton. And he wrote a paper in Harper's Magazine, 1939, so some time ago, called The Usefulness of Useful Knowledge. And I think the thrust of that is that innovation builds on research and it does not replace research. Now, well, I think one could say the same for impact. As several colleagues know, people like Alice and others said, well, you know, we don't get up in the morning and say, how am I going to waste my time today? Every one of us, well, I suppose I'm on my mornings when I feel like that, but for the most part, all of us and our colleagues are thinking, here's a really interesting thing that I really want to study because I think it's actually really important. And it's simply articulating what that importance is, as Andrew said, in a way that captures what it is that you're doing in a way that people can understand that's really important. This quote, Flexner in this article talks about a conversation he's having with George Eastman, who's the founder of Eastman Kodak, one of the innovative companies and certainly impactful companies in American life for the greater part of the 20th century, sadly no longer. And he asks Eastman, what do you think about wireless telegraphy? Who's the main person responsible for wireless telegraphy? Which was, as a communications, had huge, enormous impact. And Eastman says, well, it's Marconi, Enrico Marconi, because he was the guy who found a way to take that science and put it into a company and build technology. And Flexner's view is, no, it's not. It's Maxwell, it's Heinrich Hertz, it's Faraday. It's the people who, in the previous 100 years, had done the basic research, thinking about basic research, in a way that enabled the idea of wireless telegraphy to emerge. Of course, Marconi is not without consequence. He actually turned it into a technology, but that couldn't have happened without the underpinning research. And it is that conjunction that I think is most evident within a university environment, certainly in the UK, sometimes different in other countries. And that is, I think, the value that we can really add. And what that means, that conjunction of people really being passionate about ideas, doesn't mean that every single person has an impact story to tell right away. What it means is that simply because when you're generating ideas, perhaps just me, 9 out of 10 of my ideas turn out to be pretty useless. And, you know, I venture to say it might be a lower percentage for others, but it's probably not 100%. Every idea turns out to have real legs. And therefore, yet you cannot find the ideas that are going to have that impact in whatever way you want to measure that, unless you have a critical mass of that activity. So this ratio of 1 in 10 impact case studies to individuals is, I think, reasonable. I think that also talks to how we might think about metrics. I must admit I'm fairly relaxed for the reason that there probably are 300 or more, and each of them are equally useless or useful. And I think what we have to be worried about is what one might call spurious precision. That is the idea that by measuring something in whatever ways, multiple ways you want, that you can achieve a preciseness about estimating something, impact in this case. What we care about is a system that's accurate. And there's a distinction between those two things that I think is quite important. So I am confident that with all the imperfections that surround REF and all of the things that we will no doubt see in the future, modo grosso, it's probably among the more transparent ways focused towards excellence of some kind or another that we have for allocating public money. And for that reason, I think it is, alone, I think it's actually not the bad system. I sound like an apologist for the government here. I don't need to be, but I think it's actually not a bad way to think about it. So, overall, I would say that REF and its predecessor REE, I think, has been actually very good for raising the game of research across the UK. And whilst we sometimes feel that we didn't get as much money as we might have liked this time, I think that the fact that the UK overall is much better at research now than it perhaps was 25 years ago is good for us as well as being good for the nation. And this is not a bad way, not a perfect way, but not a bad way to start out that conversation. So I think I would still go back and stick with Francis Bacon and say it's about our universities are about understanding us, understanding the world, understanding our place in it, and making it a better place.
Ian, thank you very much, Pete.